Thank you, Ronnie. Hi, everybody. My name's Edie, and I am an alcoholic. I can tell you, I want to thank Mary, first of all, and I want to thank the committee. This is a tremendous honor and privilege for me to be able to be here and share with you. I attended my first spring fling in 1980. So that was 19 years ago, was my first, and it was over at the Wood Lake Inn. My aunt, who's got sober about a couple of years before I did, brought me to the Spring Fling. And a lot has changed in 19 years. I'm a little nervous today. But there are some people here that I really want to acknowledge that have come from my work. And it just touches me that they're here, and they're in the back of the room. And Mickey and Andre and Cindy, thank you so much for being here for me. Thanks. It's great. Andre, I was telling Andre, you know, what I'm up to, and I'm only going to talk for 45 minutes. Mary says I have to quit at 12:30 or she'll shoot me. I told Andre I was going to speak for an hour and a half. I was just playing with you. At any rate, to tell you a little bit of what it was like and what happened and what it's like today, they talk about me in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous when they call seeking lower companionship. Jesus Christ.
Could you turn that off, please?
Is it time?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. It's, it is the 90s, and information technology is the way of the world. We're not being beeped. We're getting paged or rung, aren't we? It's nothing like throwing you off your train of thought, though. So where was I? I'm seeking lower companionship. I grew up with the kind of people that they talk about in the Big Book. I am the product of a mixed marriage in the early 50s. My mother, who's American Indian and Hispanic, married my father, who is French and English. I am the product of a mixed marriage. And there were challenges growing up with that. And because not only I think that do we have difficulty fitting in as alcoholics, we have difficulty fitting in as people. And, you know, in my family, I'm always so honored to be able to share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because I absolutely know that I am a miracle. My mother, Henrietta, never made it to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've learned from the old timers in AA that the disease of alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And it is very destructive in our families. And my mother never made it to an AA meeting. And it took me a long time to be grateful for the fact that I made it to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a retread in AA. But I want you to know that how my mother quieted her madness and what happened for her is that in 1958, and I don't know what was going on in my mother's life, and I'll probably never know, but I know that she wasn't blessed with a program of AA. And I was told that she had been on a two-week drunk and that she seemed to be troubled. But my mother was the kind of person that didn't talk about what was going on. I come from a family of silence. We don't talk about those problems. Still today in the Valdez family, they don't talk about my mother or what happened with my mother. I've gone back and I've tried to find out information because I'm very curious about my mother. But what my mom did in 1958 on a Monday afternoon is she walked down the hall. She walked into her bedroom. She sat on the edge of the bed and she shot and killed herself. And when I was 3 and a half years old, I was the one that found her. So if you think that I got here with some issues about abandonment and those things, I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and Wrangler jeans and flannel shirts and 2 6-packs of beer and forget you. I had a little bit of an attitude. The first spring fling I ever went to, because my aunt put me in a car and hauled me there. I sat in the back of the room at the old Wood Lake Inn. That's where it used to be. And there was a woman there by the name of Liz S. That spoke. And, you know, I think that we keep coming to the meetings long enough that we get to hear our story. And I'll never forget hearing that woman. I was sitting in the back of the room and in that big ballroom that they had, and it was Saturday, I think she was Saturday night, and she talked about living in Downey, California, and being poor, and having the church bring food over to their home. And she got home and she found out what was going on, and she was a young teenager. And she said she found out that the food was donated from the church, and she took the cans of food and she started throwing them out the front door because it wasn't, starving to death wasn't half as bad as letting anybody know. So what I know is that you get to Alcoholics Anonymous and you get here with a lot of secrets. You know, I walked through the doors and I was somebody that was incredibly, my spirit was incredibly wounded. I was wounded. And it took a long time. My journey in AA has not been an easy one. I'm a warrior. I'm a fighter, and I ask why, and I want justice. And can you imagine? That causes a little bit of conflict. As a child growing up, I think that we get here with a lot of the things that were told to us. What I'm going to talk about today and what I want my topic to be, are there any new people here in their first year of recovery? Would you mind telling us your names?
I'm Lee. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lee.
I'm Ray. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ray.
Welcome.
I'm Margie. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Margie.
I'm Dan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dan. Welcome.
Yeah. Hi, Dave. And you're all in your first year. And there's another?
Hi, Tim.
Well, welcome to all of you. And I hope that the ones of you that identified yourself will find in Alcoholics Anonymous what I have found. And I found a home here. And what I can tell you about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is it's a wonderful experience. What I recommend that you do is you find a home group. My home group is Group 3. I think it's the greatest meeting in all of Sacramento. And I know today that I am sober by the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and great sponsorship. So I hope you find here what I found here. I was a kind of drinker that was a blackout drinker. I was a blackout puking drinker. I had my first drink of alcohol, and I think that you learn to mimic the people that you grow up with. After my mother died, I lived with some relatives, various relatives, and they were those bar drinking people. They used to go to the bars and say they'd park the car and they'd say they'd be right back, and 4 or 5 hours later they'd show up with a Coke and a bag of peanuts and say, "We'll be right back." Right, you know, and they would disappear. And after a while, and I don't know if any of you had bar drinking people come from families or parents that were bar drinkers that had you. After a while, you'd have to lay down. You'd have to lay down in the car because the authorities would be suspicious. And you know, I don't know why this day or this evening, and it was nighttime, why it was any different, but I think you learn to mimic the people that you grow up with. And the people that I was growing up with at this time in my life were not people that took alcohol and put it in a glass with ice and had a cocktail. I didn't grow up with cocktail drinkers. I grew up with the kind of people that pulled it out from underneath the seat. They cranked off the lid and they took a big drink and they grunted and they handed it to the people next to them. Now, I thought the grunting was a cultural thing, because my tata, which means grandfather, used to go to the refrigerator and get a drink of water out of the jug and always take a big drink and grunt. So I thought it was just a Hispanic thing. But this night I discovered why they grunted, because I pulled that bottle out from underneath that seat and it's a bottle of Sigram 7 and it had about this much in it. And I cranked off the lid and I kicked it back and I took a huge gulp of whiskey. You know, it just came out of my tear ducts, it made my ears pop, and I went, ugh! Yeah. And now I realize what they were grunting about is that it hurt. But it, you know, the magic occurred in just a short period of time, because I felt that burn go all the way down, and when it got to my belly, it just spread out and went, whoa. And for the first time in my life, I thought, man, you know, that warm feeling that just kind of comes over you, and you get that feeling like it's gonna be okay. It's gonna be okay. And for a long, long time, alcohol did that for me. I could get that medicine and I could make that magic happen. And I would like to tell you that when the magic went away And when that warm feeling went away, and when I couldn't no longer take that swig of whiskey or whatever it was, and that magic didn't happen, I wish that I was somebody that could say to you that I went and sought help. But that's not my story. I'm one of those people who knew a long time before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that it had not worked for a long, long time. Alcohol and drugs, I'm not going to get into the other part of my story because I absolutely believe in the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I'm going to tell you is that little white stuff just sped me up getting here. For that, I'll be forever grateful, and that's what I'll have to say about that. But I was fortunate. You know, I look back and I've been thinking, you know, what am I going to talk about today? You know, I walked through my first spring fling. I was 24 years old. You know, I mean, I just turned 45. I'm 45 years old. I'm 16 years sober. And I don't know that it gets any better than that. You know, I mean, the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous have come true in my life. And, you know, the women in the back of the room, Andrea is my mentor at work. And let me tell you, I work at UC Davis, and I am not an easy, but I have not been easy. And, you know, these three women in the back of this room have been such an incredible example to me about leadership, about dignity, about respect. And so have people like Louise and Mary. And Ronnie, you know, and Patty Kay. You know, I was in a recovery facility down in Modesto called Reality, and Patty Kay was our speaker. And Patty, I'll always remember that night. You know, you came and you were dressed in this really, really lovely chiffon red dress, and these little spiked heels, and you looked wonderful. You know, you come in and she gets up there and she starts talking and she goes, well, you know, I've come to tell you the difference between a rich okie and a poor okie. A rich okie, a poor okie's an okie that only has one mattress tied to the top, and I'm here to inform you that a rich okie's one that's got two tied to the top of the car, and that's who I was when I got here. And from that moment on, I loved her. So I had my first drink boy, you know how long it took me to get ready today? Because I wanted to look my best today. Well, thank you. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in, 79, something like that. My younger brother, Joaquin, got out of the VA hospital in Menlo Park, and he said, he came to live with me in Merced, and he said, you know, Edie, I have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, but they won't let me go unless a blood member takes me. Now, I don't know what the prerequisites for the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous are, but I can tell you this. I thought it was a good idea. So I didn't think that I was an alcoholic. You know, I just didn't think that I was an alcoholic. The woman that I lived with after my mother died is, when we went to live with her, she was in the chronic stages of alcoholism. Chronic stages of alcoholism. Really what happened is she took my hand and she took my little brother's hand and she took us to the places that women alcoholics go, where women alcoholics go to get their medicine. So without going into great detail in a general way, what I'm going to tell you as a little child, that I went to places and I seen things and experienced things that little children shouldn't auto-experience. So when I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and it was presented to me that the possibility is that I could be an alcoholic, I'm like, contraire. Contraire. You know, I have a car that's registered. You know, one of the most spiritual things that'll happen to you in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember running to Primary Purpose and bragging about the fact that I had the checks, the address on my checks, the address on my registration and the address on my driver's license matched. It matched. Can you remember that day? You know, you sit in the meeting that day and you look up at that first step and we're talking about my life is beginning to look manageable. You know, and that's a far cry from when you get here and you think there's no real problem. Right? Well, I don't, you know, I got a little drinking problem, but other than that, manageable? I don't know about that. That insane thing? Oh, please. It takes a long time for some of us to get it. It takes a long time. So in this first meeting that I went to, I don't know if any of you in your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous made up anything, but I make up stuff. I am the queen of contempt prior to investigation. I walked into that meeting and they had a sign-in sheet. So I made up, well, I grew up in foster care. I know about government-issued food. Because, you know, in foster care in the early 60s, you know, through the early 60s and 70s, the foster care providers or foster homes, you got the amount of food was given to you contingent on how many foster children were there. So doesn't it make sense that if you go to an AA meeting and they have a sign-in sheet and you grew up with a bunch of dope fiend alcoholics that I made up, that you turn the list in to a social worker and contingent on the number of people on the list, they then allocate coffee. See, I'm a thinker, okay? Now, people, you know, I mean, I'm a thinker, but I got here with low self-esteem thinking I didn't have the ability to think because we're told a lot of things when we're growing up due to the fact that Mary was a lady of the night. Occasionally she'd get picked up for her profession. She didn't quite manage herself well in this area, and occasionally she'd get put in jail for prostitution. So what would happen is we would get put in holding homes. And when we get put in holding homes, we used to be evaluated. Now, I had a man evaluate me when I was like 9, 10 years old. And I'm 9, 10 years old going on 30, right? And they used to like to take me in a room, and they had a file. See, I was really the ward of state of California until I was 18 years old, after my mother died. And the file was very thick about my, you know, my file was thick because I was quite a festive child. Anyhow, he'd take me into this room, and he used to like to, he was a child psychologist. He's an overweight man with sweat beating out of the top of his head, and he asked me questions that I felt were inappropriate. He wanted to ask me questions about my mother's death. He wanted to ask me questions that the truth of the matter is that I didn't talk to anybody about. So at the end of our little interaction, this man informed me that I was angry. I thought, my, this is a really bright man. We'll hand that to him. He is really bright. He told me that due to my anger and hostility, that I'd probably spend my adult life incarcerated in prison because I had the inability to adapt. Now, I thought, you know, that's a reachable and attainable goal. Right? You know, I come from the kind of people that take pride in their tattoos. You know, the people in the Valdez family could, you know, I was probably 8, 9 years old when I realized, you know, you can tell, I can spot a county tattoo from a state, you know, the system. If you've been in the county, you're not really a good convict. And they haven't been there long enough to really get the technique down. But after they spend time in the state penitentiary and federal penitentiary, they get better at tattoos. So I was taught at a very young age, I could look at somebody and tell. Well, there, he's not even a good convict. Yeah, you know, a real one. Yeah, these are the things that I got to you with. I knew that when I was 11 years old that I didn't want to live, you know, I had some goals in life. I knew that I didn't want to be a whore. I knew I didn't want to be an alcoholic. And I knew I didn't want to live in a Ford. I mean, these, you know, I mean, I'm clear that I'm a goal-oriented gal, right? Now, when I was in high school, how I got to Chowchilla and how I met Ronnie is I was relocated. It was only supposed to be for the weekend. What happened is the woman that I live with, Mary, the alcoholism started to take over in her life, and now we're living in Watsonville. She's doing the labor camps. She has cirrhosis of the liver. She's really, you know, the effects of alcoholism were running rampant. We lived in a hotel above an old bar. The furniture in the place that we lived was a box springs and mattress with artichoke crates, and that was our home. The reason it was so hard for me to accept that I was a woman alcoholic was, I, in my mind's eye, I think you get pictures, and in my mind's eye, I always had that picture. Dottie, you need to do something with that thing. Like, just turn it off.
Thank you.
Well, while she's doing that, does that thing have an off button? I realize that you're a doctor and they're wanting you to come to the ER, but... It's okay, Dottie. It just screws up with my train of thought because I'm thinking, my God, there's an urgency over here. And where was I? I was...
Asparagus crates.
Okay. With Mary, as a child growing up with her, I want you to know that she died when she was 33 years old. And who took care of her was me. You know, it got to the end, to the last days of her life. She drank Carlo Rossi wine out of the gallon jug, and I was the one that would pour it in those little shrimp cocktail glasses, right? That you eat the shrimp out, and then you get the little glass. You remember those?
Mm-hmm.
Right, and in the morning, what I would do is I'd pour that wine into that little cup, and I would take it over, and I would give it to her, and usually take two or three of them before she could keep it down to get the sickness off of her. So when I got to AA and they told me that I was an alcoholic, I said, no, I don't think so. See, I know what a woman alcoholic looks like, and that's not me. So part of my process of surrender was that I thought you had to be a lot worse than I was. So I had to do a lot more research. What I want you to know is that I went to live with my father 2 weeks after I went to live with my birth father. My birth father came back into my life, and he took my brother and myself to live in San Jose. And 2 weeks later, Mary died in that hotel. She died alone, her esophagus ruptured, and she bled to death, and she's 33 years old. So I know that I'm clear about the disease of alcoholism and what it can do to you and how quickly it can do it to you. So I know that I'm blessed to be able to be here. I went to live with my dad, and if you can imagine, we had a little bit of a challenged relationship. I hated him. I hated him. I just hated him. And what I want you to know is that by 4:30 or 5 o'clock today, my dad's going to be at my house, my birth father, because I have forgiven him. I know that he did the very, very best that he could do with what he had to work with. He isn't in my life as a father figure, but he's my friend. He's my friend. And I'm going to bring him to the spring fling. And he's going to get to see what celebration is about. I want you to know that my father has not had a drink of alcohol since 1972. And he does not go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I joined Al-Anon so that I don't have to, you know, Jesus. I just wish he had worked the steps. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, my God, the other day he was telling me about, you know, being in the grocery store. He's 76 years old. He hasn't had a drink in all these years, and he's standing in the grocery store in Bakersfield, California, and he sees this little girl who has this curly brown hair and these big brown eyes, and he becomes paralyzed. I just wish he had worked the steps about me. My God, the other day he was telling me about, you know, being in the grocery store. And he's telling me this on the phone a week ago, and I said, you know, Dad, and I listened to him, and I said, you know, Dad, this is what I want you to know. I didn't have the greatest childhood, but I want you to know that I absolutely believe today that it's the biggest asset that I have in my life. Dad, if you would have stayed and say we would have had the life with the little white picket fence, and I would have graduated from high school, and you would have gave me a BMW, and I would have went to school at UC Davis, do you think they'd be calling me from all over the country to go share my experience, strength, and hope? No, Dad. The truth of the matter is that I'm a woman of color that's 16 years sober that has an incredible message of hope, Dad. So you know what I want you to know, Dad? I want to thank you for that. Because as a little kid, you know, I've been through, you know how many years of therapy I've been through? How many groups I've been through? I've been through it all. I've burnt sage. I did rebirthing. I've done all sorts of things. And believe me, every bit of it helped me. And I worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got into service, and I take new people to meetings, and I, you know, I pour coffee, and I wash cups, and I take down the Christmas tree because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I asked my dad, you know, he told me he'd like to come and visit, but the only weekend would be this weekend or nothing. And I started to say, well, I don't want him to come on this weekend because, you know, I'm going to be going to the Spring Fling. And I thought to myself, well, like a light went off. Hey, Dad, I think I want you to come during the Spring Fling, and I'm going to take you to the Spring Fling. And so he's going to come, and you're going to notice, and if any of you see me with this white-haired guy who's very proper, he's very well-read, highly intelligent guy, who's writing a book on the history of theology, I'd like for you to sit down and talk to him about AA. I think he could, if he did a foursome, I think he'd get some freedom from that little girl in the grocery store. But that's not for me to say. I'm jumping around here. And, you know, I do that. 5 minutes after one. I got 5 minutes after one. What do y'all have? 10 after? I got 20 minutes. You cannot believe what I can get done in 20 minutes. Andrea, you're going to be amazed what I can get done in 20 minutes. So I didn't tell you a lot about my drinking. The kind of drinking that I was, you know, Ronnie can tell you all about it because Ronnie and I used to drink together, but I loved to drink in those sleazy little chicken shit bars that play country western music and have pig knuckles. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember pickled pig's feet. But I love to, like, you know, I love to go into those bars that you can smell two blocks away, right? Kind of a little bit dark, you know. You get in there and you start drinking a few cold ones, you know, and then you start playing, you know, Merle Haggard, "I'm Always on a Mountain When I Fall," you know, and you know, you're like sucking on a knuckle, and it's 11:30 at night, and you look across the bar and you've made a new friend, and I'm going to tell you, it doesn't get any better than that. Right, and what happens is all that goes away, and you know, I started, you know, I was telling you about my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went there, and after the meeting, after I told them all about my younger brother, they came up to me and start, and the women gave me their telephone numbers. I was offended. I thought, my God, you know, I've got a job, and I'm here because of him. It took me a lot, you know, I've only been in Al-Anon a little over a year and a half. I don't know what took me so long to get to Al-Anon. I think it's denial. I think it's denial. At any rate, I become a retread in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going and hanging out at AA because I knew, you know, I learned in that first meeting that blackout drinking is what occurs for alcoholics. See, I thought that when I drank and it went away, the memory, I thought it was because I had a low IQ. Because when I was in high school in Chowchilla, there was a guy by the name of Mr. Welk that took me in your sophomore year of high school. He took me in to look at my file about preparing me for Harvard. And he, you know, opened up my file, and he kind of looked down at my file and looked at me and looked down at my file and then looked at me and just closed my file. And he said, based on your low IQ, we don't have to do any preparation for you. Actually, based on your low IQ, I don't know how you got in general population. Now he's got me curious. And I said, well, how bad is my IQ? And he says, well, Edie, you got an IQ of 83. And I said, well, how bad is 83? And he says, well, you know, people with an IQ of 83 usually have trouble holding spit in their mouth. And I'm like, well, golly gee. I guess I'm stupid. So you got the guy telling me I'll spend my adult life incarcerated in prison. You have Mr. Welk telling me that I have a very low IQ. He told me that maybe I could try a technical school, that, you know, that would be the best I could do. It seems that I'm very, you know, I was in art and I did a lot of stuff in Mr. Langren's class. I hung out with him because you could smoke pot. And he told me if I ever got a D my general education classes, that I should really look at that as like a major breakthrough. So in the next foster home I was in, you know, I got D's and F's, right? And they were, you know, the woman, Bertie Hargis, the foster home that I was in at the time, said, you've really got to do something to improve your grades. And I said, well, you need to go talk to Mr. Welk. He said, if I ever got a D that was a breakthrough due to my low IQ, that I shouldn't even be in general population, I should. It's amazing. I can hold spit in my mouth. And so she went and had a talk with Mr. Welk. And she said that she didn't want to have that in my record. So they actually, she brought a man in to test me, to test my IQ. And what I want you to know is that I don't have an IQ of 83. I have an IQ somewhere like in the low 130s. Okay, I'm kind of highly native intelligent, but as Andre and Mickey can attest, I do not know how to spell even to this day. Most communications that I send out to campus, I send to them so that they can edit them because, you know, the words that I write, the spell check says no suggestion. But that doesn't mean that I'm stupid. It just means the girl can't spell. You know, when he was testing me, this man was testing me, he gave me all of, there's lots of different things that they test you and that they give you pictures, and you put puzzles together with pictures, and I'm like off the scale, really intelligent over there. But then he asked me about the Vatican. Now, I want you to know, being a good Hispanic, I was baptized and ears pierced at 6 months. I'm a Catholic. But I did not know the Vatican was where the Pope lived. He says, do you know what the Vatican is? And I thought, well, Vatican. I thought. And I said, well, you know, there's a lot of wineries around here, and I, you know, those big rubber things that carry wine? I'm thinking, well, you know, it's like a vat. Maybe they line it with cans. Vatican. You got a Vatican. Yeah, well, I guess you had to be there. At any rate, what I want you to know is that that little girl that was told all these things is who walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got to you, I believe that I couldn't read or write. I had a lot of hostility, a lot of hate, and a lot of shame. So it's taken a lot of work with people like Louise and other people. I've had great mentors, and I have great love for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the truth of the matter is they tell you that when you get here, that Alcoholics Anonymous, that they'll love you until you can love yourself. And, you know, you don't really understand that while you're here, when you first get here. You don't really understand the distinction of that. You don't understand what that really means. But what I can tell you is that I was taught when I was new, you know, my home group was the primary purpose, and the primary purpose put on this spring fling for the first 5 years until we turned it over to the Greater Sacramento. I was on the spring fling committee for the first 8 years of my recovery, and when I became a member of primary purpose, only the primary purpose people, were a lot of them, I think we pretty much dominated control of the committee, but we have surrendered that pretty much. But, you know, I wasn't long enough sober. I wasn't long enough sober to hold any position. So Whitey created a position. I was the very first historian for the spring fling. And they said, well, we'll just create this position. If she doesn't follow through, it will not negatively impact the conference. But I had, you know, I got these mannequins. I got these mannequins, and I put, they used to, the spring fling used to have the hostesses that wore these little unbelievable dresses, right? I got a mannequin that had it. You remember that? It was just, I had all this stuff. I don't know what happened to it. We put it in a box and somebody has it. I wish I would have held on to it. But I was able to be a part of the spring fling for the first 8 years of my recovery, and I absolutely believe that it immensely contributed to me learning how to be in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new and the people that identified themselves, what I recommend is that you get involved in AA, that you become part of the fellowship. I'm going to read something to you because it's my favorite page. And when I was publicity chair, I had actually put it in the program because I could. Because I was publicity. And I just love this part, and I'm going to read it. Because, you know, in the time that we have, I don't have a whole lot of time, so I'm going to read this. The last 15 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments because that is life. But also I have known a great deal of joy and a peace that is handmade and of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing our mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings and without obligations, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful lake so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach. God, I just love this page. The ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted, needed, and loved in return for the bottle and a hangover. We have been given the keys of the kingdom. And that has been what's been given to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I was 3 years sober, I was self-employed. That's because I was hanging out at group three with a lot of potential in noon meetings. I had a lot of potential. And it was, I don't know, Louise, you remember all of you that got together and filled out that application for that state job? Do you remember that? They put together this resume. For me, a resume. I mean, they like set me down, and you know how old members in AA, they talk and take notes. And they put this thing together, and I got this, you know, the application, and they helped me fill it out, and I sent it off to the state of California. And they sent me back a letter saying I had a test date to be an inspector, a project inspector for the state architect's office. And I don't remember who it was. I think it was Patricia and somebody else, Patricia C., that took me down and let me off at the community center downtown, and me and 700 men took a test. And what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of it is just completing the process. It's like starting out on step one and going through and, you know, finding a sponsor and somebody that you can do the work with, somebody that you can do that four step with. Because, you know, I absolutely believe that the power of the four step is what it does is like the only thing in front of me in my life was my past. And I think what the four-step does for you is in distinguishing those things, identifying those fears, and clearly getting in line in the columns. And if you do it as it states in the big book, I absolutely believe that tremendous freedom is available. And what happens in that process is your past gets taken and it gets properly filed in the past. And what opens up is a possibility of your future. And there's so much possible. I mean, so much possible. You know who got to you was a broken, hostile, angry little girl. And when I went into that, to take that test, you know, there was some, you know, of course, guys give you a little bit of a hard time. Some guy said, did you come to take the test for your dad? And I said, well, yeah, you know, he's drunk at home. Somebody's got to do it. you got to have a sense of humor. You know what happened is you're only allowed 4 hours on the test, and I took the test right up until the point they told me they kicked me out. You know, and I don't, at the time of my taking that test, I don't know. Inside, I didn't feel like I was going to pass it, but I sure felt good about completing the process. And a lot of what life is about is facing your fears and going beyond that what you think you can do. And it doesn't hurt to reach out there and do it, because us in Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship will always be there to help carry you. And you know what happened? Is I passed the test. I passed the test. And I was the first woman ever hired to do industrial inspection for the state architect's office. You know, is that like close to astonishing? It's absolutely close to astonishing. You know, I got here and I bought all my clothes in the feed store. I had no self-esteem to go into Macy's or do any of those things. I didn't feel good about myself, and I thought the best I'll ever be is a carpenter. I joined, you know what, I took Mr. Welk's advice when I got out of the high school. I joined the Carpenters Union in 1979. I turned out at a journey level, and I thought, gosh, you know, this is pretty good. This is going to be pretty good for me. You know, I went on after I was sober a few years, and I got my general contractor's license, and I went to work for the state architect's office, and I went to work on the prisons, and I was located down in Southern California, and you know, God, I was like four years sober and alone in San Diego and scared. You know, and it was a whole different distinction for me on that job, because what happened is I was no longer carrying my tools. I was somebody with authority. And I want to tell a little bit of a story about what happened, because I think it contributes to what you get taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I was the first day that I was on that job, a guy by the name of Al was assigned to me. You know, Al, been an inspector for 28 years, wore his Dickies starch to the T. He took inspection so important, he wore his hard hat inside the car. And that little Dodge Dart, you know, it's like hardly, you know, driving with that hard hat inside the car. I never knew what that was about, but, you know, I thought, this guy is significant. And we're driving, it's 900 acres, and we're driving down. He's supposed to familiarize me with the site. And he looks over at me and he says, "Well, we knew them minorities were going to show up, just didn't know when." So, you know, you think, golly, I got no banana nut bread. So, you know, what are we going to do? I thought, you know, I'm not going to, like, attack him, which was really an oddity. This is the time where you know God is working in your life far beyond anything that you would have ever done, because I'm a junkyard dog, right, that comes from the streets, and there's plenty of things I wanted to say to that old man. So I said, well, what other minorities are coming besides me? Now, for you older people and for a lot of people, I'm going to tell you exactly what Al said, because I want you to get the true essence of Al. And if I don't tell you exactly what Al said, you just are not going to get the true essence of Al. And you're not going to get how AA's really worked in my life. Al turned to me and said, "Well, we're going to have two niggers, an Indian, and a cunt. Now we're just waiting on the two niggers and the Indian." Now, this is when you're sitting in the Dodge Dart and you think, I think that the old timers taught me that this is where I practice the principles of the program. Not that I want to practice the principles, because, see, there's somebody living inside of me that had plenty to say to Al. And I don't know where this came from, but I absolutely know that sometimes God does for you what you cannot do for yourself. And I turned to Al and I said, "I really get that you must have resistance in my being here. I've never talked like that before. I get that you must have resistance in my being here. But it's not okay that you ever talk to me like that again." And I learned that from the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was on that job a couple of years, and I learned to go before everybody got there, and I learned to leave after they had gotten there to just avoid the contact. And it wasn't long before I learned to file a grievance. I went through this whole thing. There's a lot of other things, and I'm not going to go into that. The most important thing is that what I learned to do as a woman in a work environment is I learned to stand up for myself. And when I stood up for myself, I didn't stand up for myself because I'm going to sue them. I stood up for them myself so that, you know, the measurable result that I produced out of my standing up is no woman goes to work for the state of California and is located in a remote area that is not given a packet of instruction of where to call or what to do. Sensitivity training was given to all the inspectors that had to do with remote work. And that is something that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I'll always be grateful. Because I absolutely believe that when we get here, it's our responsibility to be all that we can be. Not just a little bit. All that we can be. You know, I went to work for UC Davis, and it was like I couldn't believe that I got a job out at UC Davis. You know, I came here at the spring fling. I was living down in San Diego, and they invited me to come to be a 15-minute speaker. And when I came up here, I saw in the paper there was a job out at UC Davis, and I thought, well, I'll apply for that job, and we'll just see what God has in mind, right? Let's just see what God has in mind. And I went through the process, and I filled out everything, and I mailed it off, and I got a letter saying that I needed to come for an interview. Now, I've never had an interview. The state of California doesn't have interview. Take a test, and then you get hired off of a list. So I went to Physical Plant at UC Davis, and they gave me the job description, which is 5 pages. They said, why don't you go ahead and review this if you have any questions for the committee? I didn't know anything about a committee, right? But I thought, well, you know, I'm here, and there's a woman by the name of Alabama that I used to love to listen to her tapes, and she says, you know, you just get dressed and God will do the rest, honey. And I figured, you know, I was dressed, so I figured, well, I'm already here, and it seems like this job description is a bit out of my capabilities, but we'll just go through the interview process for the experience. And five people interviewed me, and I looked them in the eye, and I was the best person I could be in that interview, and I answered the questions to the best of my ability. And 6 weeks later, they called me and told me that I got the job. right? It's amazing. I was just almost like 5 years sober, and I got this job. And, you know, the thing that I find the most entertaining is that they gave me all the Grandmaster keys to UC Davis. And, you know, being the alcoholic that I am, I went and tried them all out. And, you know, a lot has occurred for me in my career out there. About 4 years ago, there was a job for a development team. And, you know, in the middle of all of this, Andre and Mickey Mickey is the chair for SED, the Staff of American Indian Descent. And I met Andre when she was the chair of the Hispanic Staff Association. And today I'm the chair of SADAC, which is Staff SADAC, Staff Diversity.
Right.
Campus-wide Adversary Committee. I'm the chair of that. Can you believe that? I mean, you wouldn't believe the things that I get exposed to, but, and of course, they help me a lot with all of that. As you well can tell. Well, I'm going to tell you this one story, and then I'm going to close. There was this a possibility of it was called a development position. They're creating a new department. And I thought, you know, I'd like to apply for that job. But I thought, you know, it's really way out of anything that I could ever do. But I thought, well, you know what? I'm just going to go ahead and try. I'm just going to try. Why not? I love practice in life. If anything Alcoholics Anonymous and the Steps have taught me is we get to practice life here. You know, in AA and in the meetings and when we get to share and when we get to be in fellowship, this is where we dive for those balls. Yeah? You know, you see that ball coming, it's like, are you going to go for it and just kind of put your mitt out there, or are you going to dive for that baby, right? And what I've learned to do in Alcoholics Anonymous is I've learned to dive for those balls. I did. That's it. That's what I do. Because I like to live I'm very self-expressed and passionate about life. So I went to this interview and I walked in. It was one at the MU. It was in this big conference room with, in a fancy conference. It was in the me room. And this room is, you know, really, the room itself is intimidating because it's so large. And it's got a real beautiful wood table. And it's a kind where you can see the reflection of people's suits in the table. And there were like 12 or 13 people on this committee, and they asked me a lot of really hard questions. A lot of really hard questions. And I did the best I could to answer them. In the end, the last question they asked me was, you know, if you're the successful candidate in this position, you'll be interacting with a lot of highly educated people. And we want to know, you know, what is it that you do in your community that is a contribution back to the community that you live in? Now, you know, I thought to myself, well, self, you can't tell them that you're an alcoholic, right? You can't tell them that because they'll think, you know, what will they think of you? And then that other part of me said, you know, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't even be here. So I looked at him and said, I have a little bit of resistance in sharing with you what I do in my community, but I want you to know that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very involved in service work. And I told him about the H&I work that I've done over the years and the things that I've been involved in. And I said, you know, and I realize that based on this information that might be detrimental about the possibility of me getting this job, but I want to really thank you for the opportunity to be here, because from where I came from, this is nothing short of a miracle. So I want to thank you. And I left, and I never thought that I was going to get that job. And do you know what? I got that job.
Yes.
And today I'm a superintendent in facilities at UC Davis. And that is, you know where my last drunk was? My last drunk on July the 11th was in the medical center on Stockton Boulevard. They had me strapped to a gurney, right? They had me strapped to a gurney, had IVs in my arms and hoses up my nose, and I was flopping around like a dead car, right? So when they say what's possible in AA, anything's possible because we've been given the keys to the kingdom. And they say that if you're willing to do, that great things will come to pass if you're willing to do the deal. And I've been willing to do the deal, and great things have come to pass in my life. I'm going to tell you a story about an Indian, and then I'm going to sit down. I went to the Las Vegas conference for American Indians about 8 years or 9 years ago. And instead of having marathon meetings, they have talking circles. And in a talking circle, you stay for the whole completion of the circle and the communication. And there was a man that was leading that was 15 years sober and 90 years old.
Ooh.
Check that out. He's 15 years sober and 90 years old. and he was a medicine man. And he says, you know, as young people, it's very important that you go to faraway places. He says, you know, as a young child, I used to live on a reservation, and the medicine man always carried rocks. And I knew that the rocks that the medicine man carried were spiritual healing rocks. I knew that. But I couldn't speak to the medicine man until my head was atop of his shoulder. And he said, when that day come, I went to him because I wanted to be able to get these powerful healing rocks. He said, so I went to him and I asked him, medicine man, you know, what are these rocks and where do you get them? And he said that the medicine man put his arm around his shoulder and he said, well, son, I'm just moving that rock. I'm just moving that mountain one rock at a time. He says, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous as American Indians is it says in the first step that we get to do this thing together. And on some days, you know, my rocks, I can't carry them by myself. So you get to help me. And over a period of time, it doesn't matter how big your mountain of rocks is, the remorse, the problems with your family, the dreams that you never fulfilled on, the things that you never did, because it got to be a place where it's too overwhelming. In Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a place where you get to come, and every day you can move a rock. And when you're tired, somebody else helps you move that rock. And I thought that was a beautiful story. And then he said, you know, the other thing is, young people, you love to go to faraway places. My nieces and nephews and always want to go to Hawaii and Jamaica and Mexico. He says, it's good to go to faraway places. He says, and I ask of you that when you go there, that you get the soil. And you take the soil and you hold it and you feel the texture of the soil and you smell the soil and know the vegetation. It's important to know to know Mother Earth and all the different things that Mother Earth provides. He says, but I want you to know that the longest journey that you'll ever take will be from your mind to your heart. And that's the journey that we get to take in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to thank you. It's been an honor and a privilege to be with you. I can't tell you what a wonderful day it's been for me. Thank you.